felt dangerous. She wasn't sure she knew how to switch off. Sleep. She would have to go to sleep. But she didn't want to. She didn't want to dream. Didn't want to have to grieve her son's death. Didn't want to have to feel. Pope, ready a pelican. I was interrupted the last time I tried to go out and put eyes on the situation. Now I want to see firsthand what we're going to need to do for reconstruction. He nodded and left to make arrangements. Lamar detached himself from the corner of the room. He looked exhausted and more than a little sad. She wondered if he regretted his actions. Would there be an apology from him after he'd tried so hard to stop her? It didn't really matter. Governor, he looked down at the raw patch of skin on her forearm. You haven't slept in days. You need to get some rest. Trust me, I've been here before. It's going to hit you. You can't put it off forever. Rest is close at hand, she told him coolly. He heard the rebuke in her tone, which she wasn't bothering to soften now. He nodded. I understand. Is there anything else I can do for you? He had to suspect now that she would be asking for his resignation. Eventually. But he still stood in front of her, awaiting her orders. I want teams sent down within the hour into that structure they dug up. We need to take whatever the Jirohanai were willing to fight so hard for and get it ourselves before the UNSC arrives. Whatever it is, I'm willing to bet it will make all of this hell worth it. Drones go in first. Let's be very careful. Whatever they've got left down there is going to be cornered and they'll fight like it. I'll arrange it now. Of course, Elise knew that he would. Even with everything that had happened between them. He would do what was necessary. I hope you'll let me make a secondary suggestion, Lamar asked. She gave a small sigh. Okay. Here was his slack. What? We still have the perimeter mined. Let's leave it in place until we know what we're dealing with down there. I'll do more than that, Elise said. Grace says we still have a couple of rocks in geostationary orbit left with four of our ships. We'll get them prepped to aim for the area if we discover that we need to. We may have our disagreements, Lamar, but I am an engineer. I always have backups. Lamar looked relieved. Thank you. Hecabe could barely tell who or what he was anymore. The howling wind in his head that was the computational matrix of all the Sharkoi neural networks connected through a quantum entanglement array and then plugged into his own mind had scraped away anything and everything that he'd once been. It had then spread throughout something greater, and it was growing faster than he could control. All this new neural tissue, it both empowered and energized him, but at the same time, it stretched him out so thinly across the Sharkoi. How many of the creatures had he released? 1,000? No. 3,000. Hecabe had to stop and think, pull himself together, concentrate on finding the answer that might be slowly floating to him. How could he control so many Sharkoi at once? He saw himself collapse to his knees. Blood streaming from his nose. You're still fighting, the echo under the wind said. Let go. Hecabe finally did so. The wind struck him harder now, searing through every neuron. Hecabe wept from the pain of it, but did not fight anymore. He let the fury of it all wash right through him. And then he stood. He wiped the blood from his nose and looked at the terrified packs strung out midway on the bridge. They gaped at the multitude of Sharkoi placidly lined up and waiting to cross. Some of the Jirohanai glanced overhead, nervous about the commotion above. It had died away only seconds ago with a violent thunder. those who remained with Hecabe would be well rewarded for their loyalty. Though clearly some of them had unwittingly been caught with their packs, Hecabe could see they still stood here, because they regarded their leader with some measure of respect.
"Our enemies gather overhead," Hecabe said, using his own voice. "So small, so weak. We have sacrificed much to be where we stand right now. But I promise you, it will be the beginning of a new age for our people, for the Jirohanai, an age where we are finally restored to our proper might."
The packs cheered, but it was half-hearted. They were uncertain of the Sharkoi, or of the humans who had rocked the surface of the planet above. Hecabe stepped forward toward his packs, beginning to cross the bridge. The massive Sharkoi lumbered forward around him as they responded to Hecabe's will. He raised his voice with a shout of triumph. The masses of Sharkoi responded with their own deafening roar and began marching past the packs over the bridge, their movement drowning out the sound of burbling lava. The nervous Jirohanai stared as the army of giants rumbled past them, headed up the spiraling ramps carved into the sides of the shaft that led to the surface. Chai hit the warthog's accelerator and swerved past a boulder in the dry riverbed. A blast of plasma struck the rock, shards of white fire raining and rattling into the vehicle. There'd been some human ships deorbiting in the distance. Explosions in the clouds over Soraka. He hoped they were getting there in time, but it didn't look good from here.
"Adriana!"
Chai yanked the wheel, zigging and zagging them around and up the side of the banks, the wheels kicking up dust before ducking the warthog back down into the riverbed.
"Just a second."
A banshee flipped around in the air and resumed its strafing run. "Whichever Sangheili they're working for sure knows where we are now," Chai muttered.
"We're 10 minutes out from Soraka," Mike told him.
Something boomed up ahead. The shockwaves felt in the warthog. In the distance, a blanket of dirt and dust washed across the desert like an enormous wave.
"Earthquake?"
Jai asked, as the plasma fire raked across the ground in front of them, and he cut the wheel to avoid it.
"Nah, something rang the bell," Mike replied.
Adriana ignored them and walked a stream of bullets along just in front of the Banshee, letting the pilot slam into them. The Banshee took a dozen in its side before it wobbled and dipped toward the ground, striking an outcropping with a spectacular explosion.
"We're out of ammo," Adriana said, pushing back from the Vulcan and retrieving her plasma rifle from the magnetic latch on her thigh.
"Almost there," Jai thought, just as the stream bed abruptly ended. The warthog roared as they jumped out onto hard dirt and scrub. The distant skyline of the city rippled on the horizon, an oasis of greenery and steel rising up from the stark, barren wasteland surrounding it.
"Somebody took out that cruiser," Mike said, impressed.
The remains of the Jirohanai vessel burned off on the horizon. It had plowed into the desert on the other side of a small range of rocky hills that had blocked them from seeing its demise earlier.
"What do you think took it out?" Mike asked,
as two more Banshees vectored in from their side, flying low against the ground. These new craft were different. They were a hybrid of familiar Covenant alloys and strange brute iron, covered with extra cannons and boasting a menacing rows of spikes welded to their fronts. Out in the open, there was nowhere for Jai to hide. On the first run, the Banshees strafed a line of fire down the dirt and into the side of the warthog. The vehicle bounced up onto its side, riding up on two wheels for a second as Jai fought to control it. Metal hissed, blackened from the strikes.
"These aren't elites," Adriana said. "Must be brutes."
The warthog started shimmying badly as they slammed back down onto four wheels.
"I thought they were still in the city," Jai said. "There's been a lot of activity over there."
"Maybe they got pushed out," Mike said.
"Or maybe they're sentries, just making sure no one gets into the city."
Another strafing run. Jai veered hard to the left and accelerated straight at the Banshees,
trying to shake them off. He pulled up the battle rifle the Oni agent had given him, preparing to give it to Mike, and jammed a boot against the wheel. To his back, he could hear Adriana's plasma rifle open up. The Banshees kept closing in, pressing their attack. And then the one on their right started to smoke near its canard, losing altitude. "Focus on the left one," Jai said. From out of nowhere, a rocket flew languidly along and struck the left Banshee before Adriana could redirect her fire. Pieces of it spiraled apart and then fell out of the air, just as they passed underneath. Jai let the warthog slow to a stop as the other smoking Banshee slammed down into the ground and detonated. Mike looked back to where the rocket fire had originated. "Humans! Look! They're coming in weapons up," he observed. A squad wearing green and brown camouflage and slightly modified marksman rifles ran full tilt toward the Spartans from a rocky outcropping they had apparently been stationed at. "Lower your weapons," the woman in the lead shouted. "Now!" "Let's stand down and be friendly," Jai said. "It's going to slow things down," Adriana said, hopping down from the warthog's rear bed. Jai raised his hands and started walking forward. "I know. But these are local fighters, not UNSC. I want our first encounter to be on solid terms if we're going to be working side by side with them." "Nice and slow," the squad leader yelled. Jai didn't recognize the uniforms or the insignia. Not even among the colonial ones he had known from 6 years ago. The Soraka military had certainly broken with the UNSC in look. Scrappy, functional, with only a hint of structure. A ripaway name patch on the squad leader's left chest said Carson. The squad leader's eyes widened. "Holy shit. You're Spartans," she said. "We're here to help," Jai said. "We'd like to speak with whoever is in charge." The squad leader smiled. "You're too late to help." She jutted her chin back in the direction of the city. "We've already taken care of it. Shot them right out of the sky. We're in the process of cleaning up any brutes in the outskirts. But it'll be an added bonus to have Spartans as well. So we'll take you in." They're too sure of themselves, Jai thought. This was not the reaction of an army that had faced something like what the envoy and Oni agent had described back at Gila Station. It was clear that they had no clue about the danger that still lay beneath their city. Chapter 17. Rajka Kassan had gathered Melody. He now gave the human envoy the respect of using her name, and his closest remaining personnel in the bay of the Phantom dropship, which had become somewhat cramped with the newcomers. The three fighters who'd stayed behind at the facility reported that, as Daga predicted, Tharz had left the human facility before it exploded. They'd been unable to lure him in the wrong direction. So Rajka ordered them to head back for Rak. Tharz was tracking Rajka, and now he needed to make decisions about where to go, and what to do next. Daga sat across from Melody and his remaining fighters, warily watching the human. The Fleetmaster's most trusted commander had never liked the envoy, now apparently even less so. She pushed a hand to her shoulder to slow the bleeding there, Rajka noticed. Enigmatically, she did not appear the least bit embarrassed about the dishonor of spilling her own blood on the Phantom's deck. He decided to ignore it. "You tell me that these creatures from Sangheili legend truly exist," Rajka said. "I traveled to High Charity many times before its demise, yet I never saw nor heard anything of this before. I find it hard to believe."
"It would not be the first time the Sanshayum lied or kept secrets from your people," Melody said.
"That is true."
Rajka scratched his mandibles and sighed.
"Sharkor."
Rajka wasn't sure what to believe. Giant creatures that could rend one asunder with their bare hands, deployed and controlled in the thousands through some kind of neural network that the Jirohanai had evidently discovered. The human claimed other Sangheili knew of these creatures, but there were never enough to be a significant concern. Until now.
Could she be lying to me?
Yet the Jirohanae had risked everything to get to the human city. The humans already had a hidden facility here on the planet. The pieces of the story fit well together.
Even if everything you have just told me is true, I have only a handful of warriors at my command. I have no ships. I have nothing to offer. I have lost so much. You want me to sacrifice the one thing I have left. Vengeance against the Demon Three.
I have lost even more, Melody said firmly. Something in her voice caught Rajka's attention. He realized he knew so little about the envoy. The human had worked tirelessly to understand so much about him. But Rajka had never bothered to reciprocate.
I lost everything when the Covenant attacked Earth.
I joined the refugees fleeing New Mombasa. I left and tried to rebuild everything in a refugee camp on Oban. There were too many of us displaced by the war, so we lived in plastic-lined shacks, huddled around makeshift fires at night, far displaced from civilization. My government was still reeling from 30 years of non-stop war. So many people without homes, and they didn't know what to do with us. There was so much suffering, so much death. Every night, I listened to one of my neighbor's children cough, until one day, she stopped. I was so glad when I saw her at the mass burial fields later that day, because I knew she wasn't in pain anymore. There wasn't enough medicine, not enough food. You have lost so much, Rajka. That means you must know how I feel. Rajka looked away from her. I never participated in the attack on Earth. I was rebuilding ships, maintaining the fleets.
And, he realized, she was trying to manipulate him. Words were her own weapons, he could see. And she was a good warrior. A good envoy.
I don't blame you, specifically, she replied. But for years, every night, I would wake up in a cold sweat, listening for the sound of Covenant ships torching the ground, and waiting for plasma fire to sweep me away. When my own demons appear in my nightmares, they look like Sangheili firing into crowds of civilians while we tried to run for safety. My demons look just like you, Rajka.
Rajka snarled under his breath, the words striking him as solidly as the jab of a spear.
Then why do you make such an effort for peace between our kind, if you think of my kind like this?
I'm here to build something new. Something different, Rajka, she said. I want a future. I want to look ahead, not behind. And I know you want to build something, too. You came here to build a city. You risked much to come here and build something new as well.
Like you, I had little choice. I was a refugee as well, Rajka said. He turned her attacks back on her. When I learned that my family, that much of my bloodline had been destroyed on Glaki, I took command of the fleet I was tasked to repair. I led what survivors I could here, even as both your kind and mine ignored the treachery at Glaki.
He felt dishonor at first, simply complying with the Arbiter's request to bury his rage and forget the life he had on Glaki for the sake of peace between their species. But then Rajka had seen a chance to found a new lineage on a new world. And with him as Rax Kaidon, he might be able to finally make this dream a reality. The envoy thought about that. Then we are all in the same position on this world. We are all survivors of war trying to start something new. And the Jirohanae threaten both Soraka and Rax. If the Jirohanae are able to use the Sharkoi to whatever ends they seek, we will lose everything. Everything on Rakoi.
All the fighting between us will have been meaningless.
It was Rajka's turn to ponder. It's not just this planet we might lose. No, the chieftain, Hecabe, will surely raise his sights higher than this dust world, if he has the strength of the Forerunners behind him. He could attack both of our homeworlds if he is able to get his prize off the planet.
That's my thinking as well. So we have to stop this from happening, however we can. No matter what demons either of us must face.
Rajka handed Melody a plasma pistol, amused at how large it looked in her hands. The last time she'd had one like that, she'd been shooting at him from behind the door. He suppressed his sudden anger at that past betrayal, then found some small measure of gallows humor in the strangeness of the battlefield.
Very well, envoy. Let us fight this new threat together. But I will watch you carefully, he thought.
He had once believed that he could anticipate what she would do next, only to find her releasing the Demon Three and turning against him. This was a temporary alliance of convenience, nothing more. The envoy could use all the grand words and clever arguments at her disposal, but Rajka understood where she would ultimately put her true allegiance now, more than ever. He was, after all, one of the demons that haunted her nightmares.
Elise pressed on toward the massive crater, picking her way across the rubble with a small team of militia surrounding her. They had their rifles slung, but still remained alert and wary. Elise clambered up until she crested chunks of cement lining the outskirts, and looked down into the district-sized basin the Jirohanai had burned out of Karo's surface. Several militia squads had already taken position at what was apparently the Forerunner structure's entrance. Hundreds of meters away, at the far bottom, warthogs and heavier machinery drove cautiously down the slope. Some of the Sorakan ships had dropped all the way down to the surface, hovering near the crater's edge with their large hangar doors open in order to provide those working the area with easy access to supplies. Behind her, in a medical tent, she could see the bodies lined up in silent rows, like mummies. She'd stopped by the rows on her way up. Dozens of them. This was the price, she had told herself. This was why victory wasn't some cartoonish celebration and cheering. Each human life meant a loss of potential. Whatever they could have been, created, or invented, was forever lost. The lives they would have influenced would remain forever untouched. Their families would feel the sudden emptiness that she now experienced. Elise swallowed. Jeff had died out here at the hands of the Jirohanai. That thought had come and gone over the long hours, each time returning with more grief. She wasn't here among the rows of dead, thanks to people on the ground at the excavation who had fought like her son. Jeff had given his life, and now she wanted to see the reason why. There was a Jirohanai body lying under debris nearby. Elise stared at it. There were lots of the aliens still slumped and scattered all over the city. The Sorakans hadn't body-bagged any of them. So what to do? Bury them? Or heap them into piles and just burn them? Were their packs going to mourn their dead as well, on some distant world, like Elise mourned her own son? Had some of these Jirohanai been full of potential as well? Just like Jeff? This thinking wouldn't do anything useful, she decided, so she abandoned it. Her hands shook now. She could barely hold them still as she applied another stimulant patch. How many more of these things could she endure? Could too many kill you? She needed to take stock on how many patches she'd used and at what intervals. It was strange. Usually she'd be so precise about balancing something like this. But that care had been lost in the madness.
But as the new patch sharpened her senses again, she reminded herself that others had paid a far greater price. What were some shakes compared to that? Pope scrambled up next to her.
Governor, General Grace wants to talk to you.
The general and her staff were down at the bottom of the rubble. Elise followed Pope over the lip of the base and then back down to the street, where things began to look more normal.
Is the structure cleared yet? Elise asked.
The general's staff parted to let her through to Grace.
We're almost ready to begin.
But I thought you'd like to know that a patrol heading out to secure the cruiser crash site picked up 3 Spartans heading into the city. They claim they want to help.
Spartans?
Elise frowned.
Have the UNSC arrived? Did something change?
There are no ships in orbit. That we know about, at least.
General Grace cocked her head.
Tell the squad to bring the Spartans in for questioning.
Once they're detained, we can inform them that the UNSC has no jurisdiction here. We have the situation under control, and we don't need their help against the Jirohanai. But I do want them questioned. I want to know what they're doing here, and where the hell they came from.
General Grace bit her lip.
Governor, you want me to detain Spartans?
Yes.
That could be difficult if they decide they don't want to cooperate.
Elise looked around.
If they decide that,
then we'll know whether they're really here to help or cause trouble.
Make it happen.
General Grace nodded. Elise kept walking along the street, with Pope following a few paces behind.
Travis?
Yes, Governor.
We're going to have to start figuring out where people are going to sleep, since so many homes were destroyed.
People who would hold up until this was done will be coming out of the cracks. We'll need to deploy resources to help them. Escort them to Sector 31 if there's space. We can't have people living in the streets.
As they started figuring out the details, she smiled at Pope.
It's nice to be thinking about zoning and planning committees again. Building things.
Travis glanced over at the rubble.
Well,
it'll take a while before we're back to normal.
But we're headed in the right direction, she said. We're moving forward again.
And for the moment, even through the pain at losing her son, something actually felt good.
Jai watched incredulous as the Sorokin squad came into the bunker room with weapons up and tight to their shoulders.
That's saying a lot, he thought.
I'm afraid we're going to have to ask you to fully disarm, the squad leader said.
Sorry.
Orders.
Then I've also been asked to read you a formal statement regarding the UNSC and Sorokin jurisdiction.
You have got to be kidding me,
Adriana said slowly. Jai saw her hand twitch toward the rifle the Oni agent had given them. Jai looked at the wide eyes and sweat on the squad leader's upper lip.
We're here to help, he said. You can stand down.
Sir?
We're to disarm you and you're to remain here, she repeated.
There's a greater threat we need to warn your superiors about, Jai said.
Ma'am, if you'd just...
I'm not authorized to talk to you about any activities outside my field of authority. You'll have to take that up with my superiors when they arrive. I've been ordered to hold you here till then. Please, disarm. Now.
This squad leader knew that the Spartans could run right through them if they wanted to, and that there wasn't too much the unarmored Sorokins could do about it.
Let's just see where this goes for now.
Jai said to Adriana and Mike via helmet-to-helmet communications. Adriana reluctantly set the battle rifle down on a nearby table. The squad leader visibly relaxed. It was the symbol of the gesture. They both knew that the Spartans were still just as dangerous. Jai raised his hands to shoulder level, placating the squad.
Okay. As a show of good faith, we're disarming. Even though it's about to get really messy. You may want to put a rush request on your supervisors getting here so that it's not too late.
Spartans, as representatives of the UNSC,
I'm ordered to inform you that your presence here is illegal and unrequested. I'm to ask you how you arrived, what your mission is, and other pertinent queries about your presence here. Your answers will be recorded and put on file.
So you're about to be attacked by something that could wipe humanity off this planet permanently. But yes, we will stand here disarmed, Adriana grumbled.
We can still help, Jai said. They want to ask questions, while we need to pass on what we know to the highest authority possible.
The squad leader rubbed her forehead, clearly stressed.
Look, there's what I've been ordered to do, and what you need to do. I'm not an idiot. I'm going to try to find some overlap here. If you have intel that's important, I'll want someone to debrief you, even if everyone upstairs would rather that you just sat still here. I'm going to try to hunt down someone who can get the gears moving.
How long are we talking about?
Give me 20 minutes, she said. I promise, I'm not going to leave you blowing in the wind. We Sorokins may have struck out on our own here, but we fought side by side against the Covenant. I've seen Spartans in action firsthand.
Personally, if you're worried about something, I'm worried about it. Give me some time to get things moving, though. Okay?
Thank you. Jai nodded. He checked the name patch again.
Carson, what's your rank? What do I call you?
Sergeant Ray Carson, sir. She moved forward and shook his hand. As the squad left and locked the door, two of them posting up outside, Adriana laughed.
Different military, same shit. Paperwork and hierarchies to get things done.
You saw the city. It's a large ship to steer, Jai said. They're moving as quickly as they can without causing themselves trouble.
But will it be quick enough? Mike asked.
You know we can still leave at any moment, right?
Jai walked over to a slit in the bunker and looked at the city's skyline.
We have to hope this'll be quick, he told them. Give them a chance.
I want to play above board after all that's gone down. The last thing we need is to start another war between Earth and the colonies just because we picked the wrong planet to land on after a 6-year nap. We're going to need their support anyway when it comes to it. And I have a feeling they'll be forcing weapons into our hands before long. This hasn't even gotten started yet.
Chapter 18.
Did the ground just tremble?
Elise stopped looking over her notes from where she sat at a desk in a makeshift control center, hastily set up in the bombed-out first floor of a bank.
Was that her imagination?
Maybe it was time she got some rest.
But there it was again. A loud thump resounded from the crater.
What was that? She shouted. Outside the bank, militia ran for the edge of the crater only a few dozen meters away, as shouted orders punctuated the air. It looked like a hive of camouflage ants had been kicked as Sorokin soldiers boiled out of tents. So far, only drones had actually been sent into the hole at the center of the crater. But they were lost. They had ceased transmission shortly after descending the shaft. The Sorokins had been prepping a recon team per Elise's orders just moments earlier.
Whoomp!
The noise and vibration came again. From her seat, Elise could see the heavy caliber guns placed on struts up along the rim of the crater all firing at once. The deadly chatter of weapons fire didn't stop, filling the air with a constant brap. Elise moved out from the bank into the street. The sound of the guns were drowned by several pelicans that appeared overhead, firing missiles down into the crater. The street shivered again. A piece of building facade cracked and fell off rebar, slumping down to the ground in a cloud of gray dust. Travis Pope ran up to her.
"We need to get out of here," he shouted.
"What's going on?" Elise asked.
"They're pouring out of the crater."
Travis grabbed her arm.
"We need to get to safety. Now."
Elise shrugged his grip off, ignoring his urgency, and crossed the street to the rubble pile.
"Governor!"
She quickly crawled up toward the nearest emplacement. Three militia surrounded a fourth with another heavy machine gun on a tripod, shooting down into the crater. Hot casings showered the emplacement. One of them noticed her approaching.
"Hey, No civilians! Get back to a bunker!
Keeping low, Elise continued to scramble her way into place just behind a large chunk of debris that shielded the gun. As she got there, the gunner finished the belt. They changed the ammunition as one of them shifted over to her.
Get back down, he yelled at her. You too!
Travis had crawled up on his hands and knees following Elise.
That's the governor, he shouted. Sergeant, that's the governor you're talking to!
The sergeant swore and pulled his helmet off. He jammed it down on Elise's head.
What are you doing here, governor? I have to see what's going on.
The machine gun blasted away, the rest of the firing team ignoring the shouting as they continued shooting downslope.
What are the Jirohanai doing?
Those ain't Jirohanai,
the gunner spat, pausing as they fed yet another belt into the gun. Elise crawled up to the edge of the rock and peered over. Hundreds of gray monsters were swarming out from the excavated structure's entrance at the center of the crater. They looked like cyclopean nightmares. Enormous bipeds with muscles bunched and corded. Something from ancient mythology that had suddenly become very real. Their elephant-thick legs thudded as they moved. Giants above the humans, destroying everything within arm's range. But they operated with an eerie synchrony. Like bees escaping a hive, clusters of them flew toward threats and crashed into them. Militia warthogs roared around the crater, trying to engage the sudden menace, their machine guns kicking as they fired away.
They're too big, Elise said,
her voice drowned out by the sound of the firefight that had erupted. She'd never seen these creatures before. One of them plowed into a warthog, punching the vehicle with its clawed wrists and flipping it end over end. The monster half turned upslope, revealing what looked like a single eye fixed and staring in her direction. But it wasn't an eye. It was fleshy, a part of the creature's bony forehead. A surface-to-surface missile struck the monster, fired from another nearby warthog. The explosion shook the ground, and the familiar thump reached Elise. The fireball faded away, and the massive creature still stood there on the blackened ground. Unmoved. The beast struggled forward, skin burning. It didn't seem to feel any pain as it reached for the warthog skidding past and yanked a soldier from the vehicle. Elise gasped as it ripped the man apart. Blood sprayed through the air as limbs smacked to the ground. Another missile struck, and this time the beast toppled forward. But more creatures were streaming out of the ground to replace it. Hundreds now. They overwhelmed the few warthogs left in the crater like a gray wave of raw power and violence, pummeling and crushing them almost as though the many forms were a single creature.
They're breaking through,
the sergeant shouted and pointed. The creatures had now jumped over the far ridge, destroying gun emplacements as they pounded and flowed their way through.
They're going for the ships, Elise yelled.
In the distance, the creatures were striking militia deployed around one of the larger Sorakan vessels. One of them vaulted over the defenders and bolted inside the ship's main hangar bay. Elise didn't even want to imagine what it would do to anyone inside the cramped quarters there.
Fall back to Rally Point Bravo!
The sergeant grabbed Elise by the wrist and pulled her down the rubble. Just 100 meters north along the rim, a wall of gray surged its way up and over the slope, barreling through a shower of gunfire and slamming into the gunner. Elise stumbled and hopped down the debris onto the road.
What the hell are those things, Governor?
The sergeant asked.
I don't know.
Several warthogs screeched to a halt on the road nearby, and more militia jumped out. They ran up the rubble to the crest, weapons ready. Then artillery started booming from down the streets. Heavy machine guns and munitions launched from within the city. Small, fiery mushroom clouds bloomed over the crater.
Governor, we have to get to safety, Travis said.
No,
Elise said, dazed.
No, we won.
Governor!
Three of the creatures smashed over the ridge, plowing through the militia there.
It wasn't supposed to be like this,
she thought numbly, staring at the blood. Screaming came from everywhere.
Bullets pinged off the rubble pile as Travis yanked her across the street. Personnel streamed out of the command center and ran down the road away from the sound of weapon fire, but then stopped as more of the hulking creatures thudded down out of the crater and pursued them into the street.
"Governor," the sergeant said, "we've been cut off from our rally points. A squad now surrounded her like bodyguards. There was nowhere to go. Travis had picked up a rifle from somewhere, dropping everything else in the process.
Important papers. Rebuilding plans. Blueprints. Our future."
She took the helmet the sergeant had jammed onto her head earlier and gave it to him.
"No, Governor," he protested,
but she silently pushed him back and stared at the horrors around her. These massive, towering creatures clambering through the streets, openly and with incredible speed, actively seeking out their Sorokin prey. A cluster of them moved in sync to attack a Kodiak artillery tank at the nearest intersection. Despite militia firing at them nearly point-blank, the monsters moved unimpeded, almost completely oblivious to the attack, and slammed their fists into the tank's cannon until it bent and the vehicle exploded.
"What the hell had the Jirohanai found down there?"
Elise squinted as she watched the destruction move down either side of the street, the gray monsters annihilating anything in their way. Fear choked the back of her throat, but she forced it down. Soraka needed her. The fight wasn't finished yet. She might be about to die, but her mind still kicked into overdrive.
"Everything is connected," she thought to herself. "Examine what you know." The creatures were too coordinated to be individuals, so there had to be something driving their activity, as if they were part of a greater mind. They must be related to the Forerunners, and they must be under the control of something. Or someone.
Up on the lip of the crater, Elise noticed the first living Jirohanai she'd seen since the start of the attack. Large and proud, he wore the armor she'd previously seen designated for their chieftains. Shards of strange metal gleamed from his skull as he climbed up onto the debris and looked out over the chaos, intently focused on the creatures. She understood almost instantly that this was why the Jirohanai had come here. This was what they had been after the entire time. This one was somehow orchestrating all of the chaos. She pointed to the squad. "Shoot that brute. Now!" But there was no one who could even try. The chieftain was too far away, and the surviving militia in the streets had to focus on the massive gray creatures. One of the beasts, fists dripping with fresh blood, finished its carnage with a stomp of its trunk-like leg and turned toward the small group of militia around Elise at the base of the building. It charged, and the entire squad opened fire as it came at them. Ordnance smacked into thick flesh and muscle. Purple blood dripped from ragged holes, yet the creature continued inexorably forward. The squad rushed it in an effort to protect the governor. It batted them aside as if they were a bare nuisance. Bodies hit the nearby buildings with a red smack and didn't move again. Travis ran forward and fired his rifle directly at the thing's head. In response, it speared him, the movement a snake-like, rapid snap, with the two jagged spikes on its right wrist. Travis writhed and blood gushed out of his mouth as the creature lifted him into the air as if to examine his body. Elise screamed in a mix of rage and fear. She'd known she was going to die as the whirlwind of carnage took over everything around her, but now it hit her like a wall of anger.
"I stopped all this. This isn't supposed to be happening."
A rocket streaked through the street and hit the creature's chest. The blast threw Elise back, and she slammed her head against the asphalt. Dizzied, she sat up as the creature's enormous charred body hit the ground. A smoking helmet bounced at Elise and stopped at her feet. She picked it up and stared at it. A pelican flared out hard, spinning in the air just above the road and striking brick facade with its rear fins. The entrance ramp lowered into the road and her vice governor stood on the edge of it. He wore an armored vest and had a rocket launcher over one shoulder.
Governor!
Elise stared at him.
Get in!
She launched like a sprinter off the line. The moment her feet hit the ramp, the pilot opened the throttles. The Pelican clawed into the air as Lamar fired another rocket, knocking an approaching creature back down to the road. As they spiraled up into the air and over the crater, Elise could see hundreds more gray forms spilling over the crater's edge, flooding the streets and expanding out into the city. From this height, they looked like a murky and vicious disease invading a body.
"What's that?" Lamar asked, pointing to the charred helmet in her hands. Elise looked down, not realizing she still had it in her hands. The edges burned at her palms. She dropped the helmet, startled.
"Pope," she said.
That was Pope. And a sergeant she didn't know the name of, and his team, and all those other soldiers who had died in the last 10 minutes for Soraka, as well as everyone else that was about to die now.
Grit and sand smacked the Phantom as the Sangheili pilot dropped out of high speed to swing low to the ground, clipping its flight and landing abruptly. Melody winced in pain, the shaking jarring her injured shoulder. She kept a hand up to it. None of the Sangheili had offered her so much as a bandage. They'd just tried not to look at the blood that had seeped through her fingers, likely out of shame for her. Rajka stood behind the pilot. Something had their attention. The humans managed to destroy the Jirohana cruiser over the city, Rajka said, sounding mildly surprised. Melody, still pressing a palm against her shoulder, stood up and walked past Sangheili fighters to the armored cockpit. She looked at a curved display that perfectly recapitulated the lay of the land, presumably through hull-mounted sensors. The remains of the Jirohanai cruiser were buried in the desert to their left, and Soraka, finally, was directly ahead. The meddling glass skyline shimmered like a mirage in the heat that lay between the distant city and the Phantom. Rajka had made this team travel far out into the desert instead of making a straight beeline for Soraka, part of a set of maneuvers, including splitting his warriors into 3 groups to keep Tharz from tracking them. One group took to the sky in the Phantom. The other 2 remained on foot, dividing the ground craft between them. Rajka had since lost contact with 3 warriors who had reported Tharz's survival at Gila Station, though he wondered if they were still traveling to Rael, or had possibly taken a route closer to Soraka. Delays in evading trackers aside, things were about to come to a head. The skyline was in their sights now. They were only 1 or 2 out, and now they had to be cautious about human attacks.
"You know, they may not need our help after all," Melody mused, spirits lifting slightly at the sight of the burning Jirohanai vessel.
The Sangheili pilot snorted dismissively and pointed toward the far side of the city. A Sorakan ship wobbled above the skyline, smoke trailing from one of its engines. It appeared to be struggling to rise above the city.
"There is trouble yet," he said. As they watched, the ship's hull burst gouts of flame, and then exploded. Amid the falling debris was a tiny gray form, which struck a building in a shower of glass.
Sharkoi, Melody knew.
They do need our help. The attack you warned us of has already begun, Rajka said somberly.
He turned around to his Sangheili.
Prepare to disembark. We move on the ground from here.
The pilot dropped the Phantom low to the ground, spinning it about. Daga pointed a fist and the rear ramp dropped open, unloading the Sangheili in 2 columns. Rajka glanced back at Melody.
There are 2 camouflaged human scouts up ahead who have set a trap for us. I suggest you walk forward alone, Envoy, and gain us safe passage without interruption from any miscommunication.
Melody followed the Sangheili out the back of the Phantom and onto the hot, dry sand.
We may be too late, she told Rajka.
as she looked at the vast crater to her distant right, and saw plumes of smoke rising from it.
In that case, perhaps we will still receive that honorable death we were both cheated of.
Sergeant Carson and her squad had hustled Gray Team across Soraka's sandy boundaries to a new bunker on the city's fringe. More armed militia waited for them by the sandbagged entrance, to escort Jai and his team inside. Jai looked around the control and operations room deep inside the centimeters of concrete, and at the dozen or so nervous-looking civilians silhouetted by the glow of displays.
This is taking far too long. We are running out of time, Adriana noted with distaste.
Jai looked at the pale faces and muttered conferences happening all around them.
They're taking us very, very seriously now. Something's changed.
A tall woman covered in gray dust and soot waited in the bunker room. She pointed at the Spartans. Another man with civilian clothes and an armored vest stood just behind her. Everyone in the room stepped out of their way as she crossed the room.
They both reek of in charge, Jai thought.
Tell me everything you know, the woman snapped in Gray Team's direction.
I'm sorry, ma'am.
Who am I talking to? Jai asked, unwilling to give her control of the conversation at the start.
I'm Governor Elise Skass. This is my Vice-Governor Lamar Edwards. The citizens of Soraka are trapped here, unable to get off this planet while we face some new threat that I believe you know something about. So tell us what you know.
Jai saw the Vice-Governor's face twitch as she said that. Something was off. But he was forced to pay attention to the governor, who had now moved right up to his visor.
What the hell did the Jirohanai release? Governor Gass demanded. And don't give me any Oni official secrets bullshit.
You're here for a reason. What is it?
We don't have time for red tape. We're far past that point. This is my city we're talking about. Our people are dying. My people are dying.
The pain in the governor's last words was obvious. Everyone in the control room stared at the confrontation, work forgotten. The strain of battle weighed heavy on Elise, Jai thought. He understood the pain in the governor's eyes.
We came to help, Jai told her softly.
Governor Gass shook her head.
To help? Is that it?
Spartans can do a lot of things, maybe even take on one of those monsters out there. But that's not what we need right now. We need intel. We need to know how to stop them. So you need to tell us everything you know. Then we'll all form a plan together.
They're called the Sharkoi, Jai started to say.
The vice governor had stepped back in the meantime to listen to something being whispered to him. Now he interrupted.
Madam Governor, he said formally. There are Sang Healy at the city's edge asking to lend assistance, along with the Unified Earth Government envoy, Melody Azakiwe.
The governor frowned.
Oh, the one who was supposed to broker that new era of peace between us and the Sang Healy?
Bitterness laced her words. She raised a finger as the vice governor looked about to say something. Jai took the halted moment to jump in.
You'll want the envoy, he said. She knows more about the Sharkoi than anyone else.
Governor Gass turned.
She knew about this?
The venom in her voice all but dripped. If there'd been time for sympathy, Jai would have offered it. Instead, he said, it's complicated. And we can argue about it later. We don't have time to fix what happened in the past. Like you said, people are dying. We need to face what is about to happen.
He's right, ma'am. The vice governor said to her, we need all the information we can get. Now is not the time for us to assess the failures they made in the past.
The governor took a deep breath. She seemed to take the vice governor seriously, though it did not appear easy for her. Something had passed between them with just a look.
Fine. Okay then,
Governor Gass said, her voice dripping with sarcasm. Let's all find out what secrets the Office of Naval Intelligence has been hiding from us here on our own world.
Sure, bring the envoy and her friends right on in.
In the meantime, Spartan, tell me what you know.
and how you can help us.
Ma'am, I am not an expert. We just learned about them a few hours ago ourselves, Jai told her. But my team has a plan we've been working on since we were briefed about the threat.
Governor Gass leaned forward, her eyes glittering with glassy fatigue in the emergency lighting.
Go on, she said.
It's simple, Adriana said. Get us close enough so that I can take out the Jirohanai leader. Those creatures on their own aren't much more than feral animals. They're augmented by their numbers and cohesion. But they're being controlled through a forerunner device that the Jirohanai chieftain possesses, Mike added.
Kill the brute. You kill the threat, Adriana said softly, but firmly.
The governor thought about it for a moment.
Well, you'll certainly get no argument from me about the directness of this. And I've seen the chieftain. With my own eyes.
She swallowed. Jai noticed a small tremor in her hands.
Give me some time to set it up with my generals, Governor Elise finally said. I think we can get you close.
Your vice governor mentioned there were Sangheili with the envoy, Jai asked.
Yes. Is that going to be a problem?
Jai opened his mouth to respond, then realized the words weren't coming. Finally, he said,
If the envoy says they can help, I believe we can trust her.
The governor turned to face Adriana.
Spartan?
Ma'am?
Don't miss.
I won't.
Hecabe stood in the late afternoon sun of the desert world, enjoying the heat on his face. He also moved through the cool shadows of a stairwell, hunting a terrified human warrior. He perched on the edge of one of the pitiful human buildings, looking out over the crater and back at himself, the Jirohanai chieftain standing on a boulder. From the distance, he could barely make out the metallic contours of the Forerunner device sticking out from his skull in random, jarring directions, shining in the sun. Hecabe was everywhere. He forced his way awkwardly into the bellies of a handful of human ships, the Sharkoi he controlled leading Jirohanai from his war packs as they boarded the alien vessels. The humans had surprised him with these ships. He had thought them defeated in orbit, but they had actually just run away. Behavior typical of their kind. The Jirohanai followed behind the vicious giants as they destroyed the human defenders on each craft, allowing them to storm their way onto the command bridges and take control. So now, he had mobility. Hecabe laughed at the irony, and the laugh came from thousands of alien throats. A Nexus walked up toward him.
My chieftain.
He stank of utter obedience and total subservience. It smells sweet on the air, Hecabe thought. Come. Hecabe started walking. Multiple Sharkoi fell into step beside him, like protective walls towering on all sides. He felt invincible.
It is an honor guard the likes of which even the prophets never had the courage to summon, a Nexus proclaimed, glancing around nervously. Hecabe ignored a Nexus. Something odd had occurred to distract him. A Sharkoi with a broken leg, head half dashed in from a human explosion, roared in pain as it pulled itself down the road away from the crater. There was sullen determination in its movements as it tried to crawl the span of a city block toward Hecabe's original form. That one is not a part of me, Hecabe told the Nexus. Interesting. I cannot see into its mind. The implants in its skull must have been damaged. A long smear of purple blood trailed the road behind the wounded Sharkoi. Hecabe made a circle around the persistent, damaged remnant with the five Sharkoi that he now kept around him as his personal guard. The dying creature looked around, what remained of its forehead thrumming as it attempted to echo-locate and build a picture of its surroundings.
This is a Sharkoi, as they were before the Forerunners. It bleated something that Hecabe vaguely understood. It just wants to run, to be free of pain, to be free. That would not do.